I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The 2017 Maryland General Assembly opens for business tomorrow afternoon. During their annual 90-day session, lawmakers from across the state will consider hundreds of pieces of legislation on issues affecting Marylanders in all walks of life, from business and the environment to transportation and criminal justice. They'll be wrestling with big budget challenges, pitched partisan battles between the democratically controlled legislature and Maryland's Republican Governor Larry Hogan are likely. Today on Midday, Aaron Cox, the Baltimore Sun's Annapolis bureau chief, and Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for WIPR, join me with a look at some of the key issues before the General Assembly, where Maryland lawmakers and the governor are likely to clash, and where they might also find agreement. The Midday General Assembly preview starts right after the news. And welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us on this still chilly Tuesday afternoon. Tomorrow is the second Wednesday in January, and as called for in the state's constitution, that means it's opening day of the 2017 Maryland General Assembly. The annual 90-day session brings together lawmakers from Maryland's 47 electoral districts. There are 33 Democrats and 14 Republicans in the Senate, 88 Democrats and 50 Republicans in the House of Delegates. There are three vacant seats in the House. One of those seats was held by Delegate Jill Carter. She's a Democrat from Baltimore's 41st district. She left to take a position in Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh's administration. The person chosen to replace her, Gary Brown, has had that invitation rescinded after he was charged with violating campaign finance law during Pugh's campaign for mayor last year. Members will be gathering to act on a mountain of legislative proposals, some of their own and some proposed by the governor. The proposals run the gamut from transportation and energy to criminal justice reform and the environment. And observers say that the mood at the outset of this session is markedly different than the mood when legislators adjourned last spring. In part, that's because there's a whole lot less money available than appeared to be available last year. So today we'll talk about what lies ahead for lawmakers as they assemble in the Capitol tomorrow. I'm joined in the studio by two avid Annapolis watchers. Aaron Cox is the Baltimore Sun's State House bureau chief. Rachel Bay covers the legislature for us here at WIPR. Welcome to you both. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You are welcome to join our conversation as well. A phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, the handle is @MiddayTomHall. So, Aaron Cox, you and Mike Dresser wrote a very nice piece that appeared in Sunday's Baltimore Sun about what we can sort of look ahead. This is Governor Hogan's third session since he was elected in 2014. How would you characterize his relationship with Mike Miller and Mike Bush, the leaders in the Senate and the House?
Much like the weather today, frosty. Mike Bush, the Speaker of the House, and Larry Hogan have never really had a relationship to speak of. They didn't know each other before Hogan got elected. They didn't make a lot of effort to become chummy. And Bush very quickly emerged as one of the governor's chief and sharpest critics. On the other hand, Senate President Mike Miller has known the governor since he was a small boy. Miller drove around Larry Hogan's father as he campaigned for governor decades ago. And they're friendly. Their wives are friends. They have dinner together. But that relationship is fraying to the extent that that's part of the natural political cycle or not. I'm not a member of that relationship. But Senate President Miller told us last week that the governor has begun burning all of the bridges that he has with them.
And as you say, those bridges go way, way back. I mean, yeah, that was an extraordinary thing. You quoted him in the Sun and said, he's gradually burning my bridges. For Mike Miller to say that about a guy he's known since he was a child is pretty extraordinary.
Well, Mike Miller, yes, and also Mike Miller is willing to be partisan when it suits his his needs, much as the governor is. He talks a lot about bipartisanship and forging compromise and doing things that are kind of common sense solutions, unless it's something that he's not willing to compromise on, at which point he's very capable of being a partisan attack dog.
And Rachel Bay, the governor enjoys a 70% approval rating, a Republican, kind of unlikely that he was even elected in 2014, but he was, and he has maintained very, very high popularity ratings with the constituency. What's your take of the mood between the governor and the legislature in general?
I think I would describe the mood as being tense, possibly most likely more tense than the last couple of sessions since Governor Hogan was elected. You really start to see kind of the partisan claws coming out a bit, particularly after some of the vetoes that Governor Hogan issued at the end of the last session, some of them being on issues that he later came forward and kind of has introduced his own version of in some fashion. So it's there's a lot of kind of back and forth on between the democratically controlled General Assembly and the governor's office on who's got the better version of various policy initiatives, even if they look to the lay observer as very similar measures.
So some of those vetoes may get unvetoed, and they may get unvetoed in a slightly different form than they were originally vetoed. Yeah, and that's just all the political horse trading that's happening. Aaron, Gary Brown, who is a member of the Democratic Central Committee in the 40th District, he was nominated to replace Delegate Barbara Robinson, delegate who was selected to replace Catherine Pugh when she left her Senate seat to become the mayor of Baltimore. So there was a fellow committee member who was also up for that seat, Arlene Fisher. Mr. Brown won by a 5-2 vote of that panel and was appointed to the seat. The governor sent him a letter, and then stuff happened, and all of a sudden Mr. Brown has been indicted on charges that he broke campaign finance laws while he was working on behalf of Catherine Pugh during her mayoral campaign. So we don't know now who's going to end up replacing Delegate Robinson, but tell us about the process. How does this work when a seat is left vacant because, in this case, Delegate Robinson left the House to go to the Senate?
Right. So this is one of several new members this year, several vacancies caused by Catherine Pugh's election. She left. She tapped a couple delegates to work for her administration. So there's been several of these appointments. And the process is that whichever party held the seat, their central committee selects someone for the governor to appoint, and so then he appoints that person, and then that person gets sworn in. So this will kind of go back to square one, and the central committee will again pick somebody else for that district. This the central committee in the city is also picking someone to replace Jill Carter, who resigned recently to also join the Pugh administration.
Yeah, so there's all sorts of machinations that have to happen for that. Arlene Fisher is the president of the Lafayette Square Association. She was up the last time. We'll see if she's ends up being up to again. You wrote a piece that appeared in today's paper about Delegate Dan Morheim. He's having some ethical challenges. There's some questions about his relationship with he's a physician. He's the only physician, I guess, or the longest serving physician in the Maryland legislature. And it has to do with the medical marijuana industry. Give us an update on what's cooking with that.
Absolutely. So in fairness to Delegate Morheim, he's not been convicted of any ethics violations, and he contends that he broke no rules and is, willing to cooperate with any ethics probe that exists. So in fairness to him, I want to make sure that we say that. So Delegate Morheim was the chief architect of Maryland's medical marijuana law. This is something he has been pushing for years. He helped shape the law once it was passed. He put in legislation to reshape it, expand the amount of providers that can recommend the drug, expand the patient base, create. He was at the center of creating this medical marijuana market. At the same time, he quietly agreed to be the clinical director of a dispensary that they applied to with a company called Doctor's Orders, which won a grower's license and a processing license. And so at the same time where he had made an agreement to run one of these, he was testifying in front of the Medical Marijuana Commission and lobbying other lawmakers about changes to the law without expressly disclosing that particular relationship. He did make a disclosure saying that he might consult for them, but he did not tell anybody publicly that he was going to work for this company called Doctor's Orders. So the Legislative Ethics Committee, which reviews the conduct of legislators in Annapolis, met in October to decide whether or not they were going to pursue a further investigation of Morheim. All of those decisions are confidential, so we don't know whether they made that decision or not. But what we do know is that yesterday, House Speaker Mike Bush, who controls committee assignments, took Morheim, the longest-serving physician in the General Assembly, off of a key health policy committee that he's been on for nearly 15 years, and in doing so also stripped him of a leadership post. So he's clearly being punished by the leadership of the House. Whether or not there's will ultimately be an ethics finding, a fault or not, we don't know. But the action yesterday indicates at the very least that the House leadership is displeased with his conduct.
And Rachel Bay, another delegate in the news for reasons he wishes he weren't, is Richard Impalaria. He's a Republican from Harford County. He was convicted last week stemming from a stop for being impaired while he was driving in Ocean City last August. It's a misdemeanor conviction, so there's no automatic, he's not getting automatically kicked out of the House of Delegates, right, as we understand it?
That's how I understand it, yes.
Yeah. So he seems to, at this point, have survived whatever he has to survive. So with the exception of these couple seats, two or three seats that remain to be appointed, we'll just sort of see what the how it all shakes out. I want to ask, before we take a little break, about this ritual that people refer to as the Begathon, where school superintendents from the jurisdictions around the state come and they are required to go in front of the governor, I guess it's the Board of Public Works, is that right, Rachel? And state the case for funding for their jurisdictions. A lot of legislators think that that's a bad idea, Aaron. Is this at all indicative of how the legislature feels the governor is governing? I mean, is this a window into the governor's personality and modus operandi and style, because they think he's badgering these poor superintendents who have to come begging for their money?
Well, it's a window into several things. Under O'Malley, there was a question about whether or not the Begathon was demeaning or a waste of time or something that should or should not be done. Under Hogan last year, who has consistently used the Board of Public Works Forum to talk about his agenda, to be very forceful in his opinions about state spending and state contracting, and has been willing to call people publicly to account for things that in the past might have been handled privately. So in the wake of that, the legislature voted to do away with this. And they did it in I believe they tucked it into budget language, but they did it in a way that wasn't necessarily passing a law. They did it in a relatively quiet way to tie his hands. And his response to that is like his response to many of the ways that the legislature has attempted to curb his power or limit his influence, was that he got a legal opinion that he believes is sufficient to let him continue doing what he wants. So he has decided to reinstitute the Begathon and have state school officials come and publicly account for why they deserve state taxpayer dollars. Again, this is something that the leadership in the legislature, and keep in mind, like, this is, we're getting close to an election year. This is something that they characterize as, the governor being a bully, that these decisions shouldn't be politicized, they shouldn't. These are public servants. There aren't people that should, have to endure any sort of public scouring. But the governor's office thinks this is an important piece of transparency and public accountability.
Yeah. And of course, there are folks who think that this entire session here in 2017 could be a sort of warm-up, a preview of the gubernatorial race that will take place in 2018 when the governor, we assume, will stand for re-election. All right, we're going to take a little break. Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun and WIPR's Rachel Bay join me today. We'll have more on what's in store for the Maryland General Assembly and how Maryland lawmakers plan to deal with the newly empowered Republicans in Washington after, as I said, we take a little quick break here. When we come back, we'll take your calls and comments, 410-662-8780, midday at WIPR.org is our email address, and at midday Tom Hall is our Twitter handle. Glad you're with us. Stick around. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, New York Times investigative reporter Scott Shane joins me here in Studio A. He's part of the team at the Times who has been covering Russia's efforts to hack into U.S. political and government computer systems and spread disinformation in an attempt to influence the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday, right after a press conference with President-elect Donald Trump, which is scheduled to begin at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. So we'll carry that press conference live for you here on WIPR, and Midday will chime in at noon. If you're just joining us this hour, we're talking about what's ahead for the 2017 Maryland General Assembly, which begins tomorrow in Annapolis. It's a session likely to be marked by partisan wrangling over a host of thorny issues between the two democratically controlled chambers and the state's Republican governor, Larry Hogan. That's a prediction being made by most political observers, including the two State House reporters who are with us this afternoon. Rachel Bay covers state politics for us here at WIPR, and Aaron Cox is the Baltimore Sun's State House Bureau Chief. We are delighted to welcome you to our conversation as well. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle, at Midday Tom Hall. Rachel, when the legislature adjourned last April, they had a modest budget surplus. There was even talk about maybe a tax cut happening in the current session that starts tomorrow. But all of a sudden, revenues appear to be considerably shorter than the projections that were made last year. So what's happened? Is it a revenue issue? Is it a spending issue? Why all of a sudden is the amount of money that's available now so much less than it was last April?
The answer coming from the Department of Legislative Services on this is really, they point to spending. They say spending has been increasing just at a much more rapid clip than revenues have been able to keep pace with. That would be the short answer of it.
And then a second piece to what Rachel just said is that there's been a relatively high error rate at estimating how much money is going to be available, that the state budget forecasters thought that wages were going to grow faster than they did. They wildly underestimated how much wealthy people were going to earn in capital gains income and how much they were going to earn in the stock market and how much they were going to be able to collect. And so this combined are kind of the major reasons why you see a swing of roughly $1 billion in anticipated revenue over the next couple of years that has basically just evaporated.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, if you just take the stock market, for example, capital gains and that sort of thing, the stock market is knocking on the door of 20,000 points. I mean, it's much higher than it was 6 months ago, a year ago, certainly 5 years ago. It's amazing how they can overshoot the mark, even though, you know, capital gains, it would seem, should be up. I mean, people are making money in the stock market.
Well,
who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that, you know, and we try to explain it simply, but it is not a simple mathematical
right.
calculation to figure out, you know, how much the state's going to take in revenue. They take in roughly $17 billion in state tax money. And so being off by you know, a couple hundred million dollars per year, you know, compared to $17 billion, you know, they are relatively close to the mark when you look at it that way, but they're not close enough in the mark to be able to let lawmakers know whether or not the state can afford across the board tax cuts.
So, Rachel, it's very unlikely that anybody's going to be proposing a tax increase or increase in fees. So if we're talking about cuts, and there are estimates that it has to be somewhere between $400 and $544 million worth of cuts, where can the legislature look for that?
Well, so the legislative leadership points to really three main parts of the budget that could be cut. You've got education, that's both K through 12 and higher ed. You've got public safety, and you've got healthcare spending. And the Democrats, the legislative leadership at least, has more or less promised that education won't be touched and healthcare will be more or less safeguarded, leaving public safety at risk. Now, of course, Governor Hogan actually releases the budget. So it to some extent depends on what Governor Hogan's administration puts in that budget that we have not yet seen. And leadership is very quick to point out that they don't have full control where the budget is concerned. But that those are the three areas to kind of watch.
Generally speaking, when can we expect a budget from the governor's office?
It's usually a few weeks, maybe about a month into session.
Right. There's a deadline in the second or third week for the governor to announce this. And I also to elaborate on one of the points that Rachel made, that and this highlights what we were talking about earlier with a very partisan nature of this year's cuts. Like if you had a Democratic governor and Democratic General Assembly, there would be some sort of negotiation to cut the budget in a way that made everybody come out smelling like roses. This case, leadership is very quick to say, we don't know what we're going to cut. Larry Hogan's going to have to make his choices. Larry Hogan's going to have to choose what gets cut. And they're definitely laying out the dominoes, so to speak, that when cuts come, they'll be able to blame them on the governor and not have to take responsibility for them.
And one thing that they've made clear is that it's not, with the amount of money that they're going to have to save in this budget, it's not going to be just little nips and tucks. You're going to see entire programs losing funding.
And, of course, one of the things that irks the governor more than perhaps many other things is this notion that people refer to as mandate relief, because there's so many things in the budget that are mandated by the legislature that the governor is saying, there's nothing I can do about this. So he's saying that his hands are tied. Is there any movement towards loosening that up? I mean, Aaron makes a really great point about the politics of it. Now the Democrats, you know, perhaps waiting for the governor to sort of shoot himself in the foot and have to make a stand about things that he's willing to cut. But where does the notion of at least slightly attenuating the mandates that are baked into the cake of the budget?
So this is something that the governor prioritized last year and has made it clear he's prioritizing again this year. It didn't get very far last year, so there aren't necessarily high hopes for it moving very far this year. When he's talking about mandate relief, he's basically saying that there's roughly 80% of the budget in a given year is full of mandated legally contracted spending increases, even for certain parts of the budget. For example, K through 12 schools is one of the big mandates that has to grow every year. There are some tricks, some budgeting gimmicks that they can use to kind of reduce some of the amount of spending that they have to spend on those mandates every year. And that's kind of what happens when you get to the reconciliation of the budget.
Rachel Bay covers the State House for WYPR Radio. Aaron Cox is here in Studio A as well. She's the State House Bureau Chief for the Baltimore Sun. You are welcome to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780 here on Midday. Midday at WYPR.org is our email address, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So if we think about these three areas that Rachel mentioned, higher ed, public health, and public safety. Speaking of public safety, we have a caller on the line, Doug Colbert, who is a well-known lawyer here on the faculty of the University of Maryland Law School. Doug, welcome to Midday. Happy New Year.
Well, thanks so much, Tom, and to you and your guests, and thank you for this very important show. Mine is an ethical question. Often I find myself in Annapolis. One of our big causes happens to be bail reform, and the insurance company's interest in maintaining the money bail system. And I've always wondered why the legislators who may have a conflict of interest because of the large amount of contributions that they receive from the bail bond industry or the insurance company industry, why isn't it required that they reveal the amount of money that they have received on different issues? And I know this is a general issue as well because of how the money interests are able to make these kinds of contributions. I teach ethics over at the law school, and to me it's mind-boggling when lawyers are receiving money from one party, it requires that they disclose and sometimes that they disqualify themselves. But it seems as though it's a 500-pound elephant in the room. Everybody knows that they're getting money, but the public interest is not being served by non-disclosure.
Well, Doug, thanks for the call. Aaron Cox, this is a part of a package of crime-related legislation that the legislature might be considering. I guess a decision about bail reform has been postponed. Do I have that right?
Right. So there's the state's highest court is considering issuing a rule on how judges should use cash bail. So this isn't something that, the legislature could still choose to take up the issue and decide whether to totally abolish the commercial cash bail system as or whether to implement some other legislative fix. The judges convened and have taken a lot of testimony and considering writing a different rule, advising people on when you can use cash bail, the concern being that whether or not judges should consider a defendant's ability to pay. Attorney General Brian Frosch, and I believe Eric Holder came and testified last week on this issue, saying that it's a violation of civil rights to jail someone because they can't afford to get out. So that's kind of the context of the issue that we're talking about here, that the professor's calling about, is to what extent Maryland lawmakers are responsible for abolishing or dramatically reshaping the cash bail industry in Maryland. And to his question about disclosure, I suppose I have a question back to the professor. When you talk about lawmakers needing to disclose this, disclose in what way? All of their campaign finance reports are public, accessible online. If you want to know how much a bail bond company gave to an individual legislator, you can go and look that up. If you want to know their sources of income, you can go pull their ethics form and go see what they make. That said, all of the ethics laws are written by the legislature. So
Doug Colbert, what do you think about that? I mean, is there information that you think they're not providing that should be provided?
Well, we just had a situation where the Chief Judge of the United States Supreme Court, John Roberts, revealed that he owned stock in a company in a case that was before the court. And the requirement there is not simply to disclose, but it's disclosure with an eye to disqualification, to recusal, because the appearance of justice can easily make one of the parties believe that the chief judge's opinion would not be fair and impartial. And so we require not simply that I own stock, but for someone to say I own stock and I can tell you that that would not affect my decision because I own $1,000 as opposed to I own $250,000. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. It would seem to me that legislators have a reporting duty, but they don't take the next step, which is to at least assure the public, I'm telling you this, and I'm also telling you I can rule fairly in this case.
Do you think it's possible that the legislation could be crafted to require legislators to recuse themselves on votes regarding, like, the bail bond industry if they've got contributions from that? I mean, if we started doing that, that seems to be a slippery slope down a very long hill. I mean, if everybody's going to recuse themselves from votes concerning industries from which they get campaign contributions, that could be tough, right?
Well, the professor brings up an interesting tension that exists with Maryland's legislature that was designed from its early days and remains a citizen legislature, that the idea is that all of the people who represent Marylanders have day jobs. that they're not full-time politicians. They are not paid to do that role. And I, you know, without advocating for or against Maryland's current ethics laws, one of the reasons they exist the way that they do is to promote disclosure, not necessarily recusal. And I think that, we can have a conversation about whether the way in which the disclosures are done now, whether those are accessible enough to the public or transparent enough, or that it's being revealed at a relevant time in the debate. But to the point of whether or not lawmakers should recuse themselves from matters which they affect their personal lives or their business dealings, that there has been a longstanding tradition in Maryland that you have criminal defense attorneys on the Judiciary Committee helping craft laws that could arguably benefit or hurt their clients. And that is by design, so that people familiar with the industry are crafting those laws.
Yeah, that's a complicated stuff. Doug, we will have you on the show sometime soon to talk more about bail reform. This is an issue that we're certainly keeping an eye on here at Midday. But thanks for your call today, man. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks to your guests.
Rachel, let's talk about another issue, which is the issue of paid sick leave. Governor Hogan seems to back a particular version of this legislation. Where does that stand? This would require employers to compensate people who are sick.
Right. There are two different competing measures at the moment. There's the Democratic legislators who introduced this for the last 4 years have now introduced it for a fifth year, and basically their version requires businesses with at least 15 employees to provide a certain number of paid leave days a year, and smaller businesses would be required to provide protect employees from being fired for leaving for sick days, even though they wouldn't necessarily be paid on those days. The governor's proposal would raise that bar to businesses that have at least 50 employees, and would provide tax incentives to smaller businesses that want to do the same. There's also some differences in the two proposals over the governor's proposal would supersede local laws. So there are in Montgomery County, I know there is a paid sick leave law already in place. The governor's proposal would basically raise the bar in Montgomery County for businesses that need to require or need to offer paid sick leave to its employees.
And this is a public health issue. I mean, people bring up the horrible circumstance at Chipotle restaurants last year where just many, many people had a norovirus caused evidently by some employees at Chipotle who did not feel that they could skip work. I mean, if they'd skipped work, they would have not been paid. And so, you know, they were put in a really tough position, and it turns out it became a public health issue. So it sounds like this is something that they'll be able to work out, though. I mean, if they're this close, if it's 15 employees or 50 employees, I mean, it sounds like this one might happen this year.
Except that it's on the backdrop of whoever wins this argument gets a political win. And, you know, the Democrats are looking to,
have as few of those as possible for the governor.
Yes. and
I will say that
I'm shocked. Shocked that there's liquor served in this establishment. Yeah.
The version that is now being introduced passed the House last year, but couldn't get through in the Senate. So there are definitely some hurdles still ahead for this, and it remains to be seen whether they'll be able to come together on a compromise.
We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk about one of my favorite bills, what the governor calls the roadkill bill. Erin Cox is the Baltimore Sun's State House Bureau Chief. She reports on Maryland politics and state government. Rachel Bay covers state politics for WYPR. We invite you to join the conversation. What issues do you think should be front and center for the Maryland legislature during this 90-day session in Annapolis that begins tomorrow? 410-662-8780 is where you can call. Midday at WYPR.org is where you can email, and at Midday Tom Hall is where you can tweet. Stick around. We'll be back in a flash.
You're tuned to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what's in store for the 2017 Maryland General Assembly. The annual 90-day session begins tomorrow in Annapolis. It's a session, as we've heard, that will almost certainly involve some bitter partisan wrangling over issues from transportation to the environment and some potentially painful budget cuts. The democratically controlled legislature and the Republican governor, Larry Hogan, may be going at it beginning tomorrow. Let's continue our conversation with Aaron Cox, who covers Annapolis for the Baltimore Sun, and Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for us here at WIPR, and with you. 410-662-8780 is our number. Midday at WIPR.org is the email address, and at Midday Tom Hall is the Twitter handle. So, Aaron Cox, when it comes to transportation, the governor is none too pleased with a piece of legislation that requires him to publicly score transportation projects to determine whether or not they're adequate, viable, fair, et cetera. He has declared this a kind of a top priority, and the leadership of the House and the Senate have declared the bill dead on arrival to try to repeal this law that he vetoed last year, but then they overrode the veto. So where does that stand?
Well, I think you summarized nicely where it stood. The governor has said that he finds this unacceptable. He has a whole list of very fun adjectives to describe the bill and the lawmakers who passed it as irresponsible, reckless, outrageous, and has promised in his reading of the bill that he believes that it requires him to cancel most transportation projects in the state. And he has made clear that that is his intention if this bill is not repealed. So this is a bill that was is described as a transportation scoring bill by its advocates. It requires them a public ranking of all the transportation projects. And then if the governor doesn't fund them in the order in which they're ranked, he has to explain himself publicly. And so the advocates for this law say that the governor has an out, that he has discretion and he could continue to choose whichever projects that he thought were best so long as he explains himself. And the governor disagrees strongly with that and has promised that not only that he will cancel these, but he has made clear he will make political hay out of it. He has already started running ads in Mike Miller, Senate President Mike Miller's district, saying that Mike Miller is working to kill a bridge project because he won't repeal this law. And this is something that the Senate president has taken very personally and has said that they're just not going to repeal this bill. So this is something that the actual policy is relatively narrow, but the political sweep of this debate is likely to take a lot of suck up a lot of air in the room over the next couple months.
So, Rachel Bay, is this one of those instances where, you know, Democrats read the language in the bill just much differently than the governor reads it? I mean, they say that, you know, ultimately the governor can decide what transportation projects go forward and which ones do not. Are they just reading the same words and coming up with a different summary?
Well, yes, but I will say that the Attorney General's office has also issued an opinion on this bill and has come down on the side of the legislators, has said that the governor has no obligation. And by the governor, we actually mean the State Department of Transportation. The State Department of Transportation has no obligation to fund any project it doesn't want to fund, basically, and has no obligation to defund projects it doesn't want to defund. The only change here is that they have to provide this written explanation, as Aaron just said, that if they choose to fund in opposition to where the scoring or the ranking comes down.
So, yeah, and the governor's saying this is cumbersome, it's too much extra paperwork, it's a bureaucratic nightmare, you know, so we'll see how that comes out. Let's talk about the environment and fracking in particular. We have Frank on the line from Aberdeen. Frank, welcome to Midday with Aaron Cox and Rachel Bay.
Good afternoon. First, I want to make it clear that I'm totally opposed to fracking, but I have at least four concerns. In the regulations, they must mandate that water samples be taken before, during, and after the fracking process so we know what's happening to the water supply. Second, there should be strict liability imposed on these companies for any damage not only to the leasehold but to the community. Third, there should be significant bond requirements that they need to post to guarantee payment of those damages. And fourth, their secret formulas need to be revealed so we know what's being put into our Earth.
Well, Frank, thank you for your call and for your very interesting assessment of what needs to be in a bill that may be introduced by Bobby Zirkin to propose a complete ban on fracking. Aaron, where do you think that's going to head?
Well, you know, it's as I keep saying that it's actually election season, so predicting what any compromise will become has a often has a lot to do more with policy than, excuse me, with politics than policy. A lot of the proposals that Frank mentioned have been introduced as individual bills in the past as an effort to put stricter requirements on fracking, and they have not passed. I haven't really seen a lot of political shifts that change the landscape since those last failed. But again, some of these ideas about requiring fracking companies to tell the public what's in the fracking fluid that they put in the ground, or having them agree that if anything happens anywhere near any of the fracking wells, they are strictly liable for any damages. I mean, those are things that will continue to be debated. I haven't seen any evidence that that it will get any further than it has in the past. But, you know, it's election year. You never know.
So Frank's talking about if a ban is defeated, he hopes that these four things, the water samples, the liability issue, the bond requirements, and the revelation about the formulas be included if it's not outright banned. There are local fracking bans. So if, Rachel, if a fracking ban is defeated, do those stay in place? Or if a fracking ban is adopted, how does that affect the local?
So the Attorney General's office just issued an opinion on this last week. And their answer was not totally definitive, actually. What they basically said was it depends on the local ban and how it's written. So it may be that those local bans that are in place in places like Friendsville and Frostburg and Mountain Lake Park in Western Maryland, that they may be able to stand even when the governor's office, the administration, begins issuing drilling permits in October. But that may have to be litigated. It may not be immediately clear, and it may have to be decided in court.
And you had a great story about that this morning here on WYPR. This is likely to be one of those issues that has not just one bill, right? There could be a package of bills concerning fracking.
Yeah, there's a lot of movement on this issue. As Aaron said, that this has been these measures have been defeated in the past, and nothing has really changed on the partisan lineup here. So it's not totally clear if there's going to be a new future for these. But you'll see extensions of the moratorium, most likely. You'll see
The moratorium is set to expire
October 1st, yeah. Depending on how quickly the regulations become finalized. You may see a new ban proposed. Most likely you will see a new ban proposed. And you will also probably see additional regulations proposed in various types of bills. And then you also have the regulations are actually currently being held up in a legislative committee. To be fair, the committee doesn't really have that much power to alter the regulations. They can't really require the governor's office to alter them. They can just kind of hold on to them and allow people to issue more opinions and issue more requests for those regulations. But end of February, they have to release the regulations, no matter what they look like.
410-662-8780 is the number to call here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. I'm here in Studio A with Rachel Bay from WYPR and Aaron Cox from the Baltimore Sun. Aaron, let's go to the issue of medical marijuana and the process for issuing licenses to people who can develop these businesses. This is a thing you write about in your piece with Mike Dresser that ran a couple days ago. It's an issue that the Legislative Black Caucus may decide to sort of flex its muscles about. They're concerned about the paucity of minority owners of these potentially lucrative businesses.
Right. So if we back up a little bit, when Maryland passed a medical marijuana program, lawmakers wrote into the statute that the Medical Marijuana Commission was required, among several other things, to consider ethnic and racial diversity in awarding these licenses. And so 22 companies have been awarded either licenses to grow and or licenses to process the drug. And there is a very small number of minority-owned or minority-led firms. And so that prompted the Legislative Black Caucus to say that they would like to restructure the Medical Marijuana Commission and look at any number of alternatives to try to remedy that. And they've proposed everything from stripping the Medical Marijuana Commission of power, of issuing more licenses that they would hope would go to minority-owned firms, of putting a halt to the entire process until they set this out. But this is among the top priorities of the Legislative Black Caucus, which has reorganized, gotten new leadership this year, and intends to be a bigger political force.
Thurgood sends us a tweet and says, what are the chances that the General Assembly takes seriously a cannabis legalization bill, Rachel? I mean, this is not just for medical. I mean, have you heard any movement? It's happening all around the country. I mean, different states seem to legalize marijuana for recreational use each year. Any chance that that'll come up in Maryland?
It may very well come up. I haven't seen a lot of legislation on this already at this point, but it's still early. The session hasn't begun yet, so it very well could come up. I'm not sure also what the success rate of that would be. I don't think that there may not be enough appetite for that to pass in Maryland at this point.
Aaron, back to the issue of crime. Just got a couple minutes left here. The Attorney General, Brian Frosch, issued a report talking about statewide standards on rape kits. Do we know anything about that? Or, Rachel, is that something you've been paying attention to?
Yes. So he basically looked at the number of anonymous and other rape kits that have been held by law enforcement agencies untested around the state. And just to be clear, this is not a backlog. These are not kits that are waiting to be tested. These are kits that different law enforcement agencies decided not to test for one reason or another. And he's effectively advocating a list of uniform policies on how to deal with these types of rape kits that are not being tested, when to actually test them, when not to test them, when to throw them out, things like that. The General Assembly will have to move forward on some of those recommendations if they are to have any weight, any power, and possibly even all of the recommendations could be seen as bills in the General Assembly this year.
It's an astonishing number. I mean, something like 3,700 kits haven't been tested for one reason or another, so we'll see where that goes. Before we finish up, Aaron Cox, your take on the impact of a Trump administration on a Hogan administration here in Maryland.
You mean this over the next 90 days or over the next couple of years?
Well, yeah, both. A couple of years. I mean, obviously, there's a Republican administration as opposed to a Democratic administration. There is. Mr. Trump has made noises about infrastructure programs that he's interested in doing. Whether or not that'll pass through the U.S. Congress and Senate remains to be seen. But do you think?
Well, let me say this. Larry Hogan has demonstrated that he is a pragmatist above all else. And so, I mean, at the same time that he has sought to put sunlight between himself and a Trump administration who, you know, Donald Trump did not do very well in Maryland in November. If Larry Hogan hopes to get reelected, he can't be seen as a different version of Donald Trump. I mean, but aside from that, there are very distinct people with very distinct policy ideas. And so I think he's going to seek infrastructure spending where he can and seek to put distance between himself and the Trump administration where he can.
All right. Much remains to be seen, and we shall stay in touch with both of you as we start seeing it tomorrow afternoon at noon. Thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. And best of luck. Break a leg covering the legislature this session. Rachel Bays, the State House reporter for WYPR. Aaron Cox, the Annapolis bureau chief for the Baltimore Sun. We will, of course, have continuing coverage of all that goes on in Annapolis in this year's General Assembly. Stay tuned to midday to On the Record with Sheila Cast and to the WYPR news team for all the latest news from our state capitol. That's it for us today. Tomorrow on midday, what the Russians did during the presidential campaign to influence the election and how the U.S. may respond moving forward. All U.S. presidents hope for a reset with Russia. Will President-elect Trump initiate a different kind of reset given his adulatory tone towards Vladimir Putin during and since the campaign? We'll talk to New York Times investigative reporter Scott Shane. He's been covering the cyber war between the U.S. and Russia. That's tomorrow on midday, right after Mr. Trump's first press conference, which is scheduled to begin at 11 o'clock. You'll hear that live here on WIPR. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Thanks for tuning in. You can catch up on shows you might have missed at wipr.org/midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for spending part of your afternoon with us. Have a great day.